Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, and many thanks to CAUSE for giving us this venue at late notice because of our overcapacity audience, 41 Phillip Street. Our speaker today is Barry Cohen, who makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. It's a long time between speeches. He was last year, we think, in 1991, talking about Israel and the peace process, but this is the first time he's been here on the occasion of one of his many books, and I'll introduce him briefly because he's well known. Barry Cohen was a Member of Parliament for 21 years, and for 4 years was Minister for the Arts, Heritage and the Environment in the Hawke Labor government. He's also served as a columnist for The Bulletin, for the Sydney Morning Herald and the Melbourne Herald, and now writes for The Australian and The Spectator Australia. And this, Bringing the House Down, is his 10th book, and he's going to speak for us tonight on his 10th book on the topic of Bringing the House Down. Barry Cohen, you're very welcome. Thanks.
Okay. Just in case I get stuck. Well, Jared, firstly, let me thank you for inviting me to address the Sydney Institute. When you get that invitation, you know you've arrived. The Institute does a fabulous job providing a forum for politicians, academics and the commentariat to air their views safely. Tonight, I hope to amuse you with the lighter side of politics. This is my, you said ninth book, well yes, ninth or tenth, it depends. One book was on the Olympic Games, which was done by myself and a number of other people, but let's not quibble about that. This is my ninth book, and tenth book, all but one of which has been anecdotal. I'm often asked what prompted me to do it. The simple answer, it was fun. I didn't start off to put together a book of political humour. But I heard and witnessed so many hilarious things in Canberra that from the day I arrived in Canberra, I started to collect them and file them away. The idea for a book came about when Kim Williams and his then wife, Kathy Lett, were staying with us at our home in the Central Coast. At the time, I was Minister for Arts, Heritage and the Environment, and I entertained them with some stories. Kathy said to me, "You must write a book." I said, "Well, look, I know I can tell the stories, but I don't know whether I can write." She nagged me for about a year. At the time, Kim was head of the Australian Film Commission. After I had entertained them with some stories, Kathy said, "You must write a book." She nagged me for about a year before I put pen to paper. 6 months later, in late 1987, thanks to Kathy and Jill Rann, Life of the Party was launched. It was the first book that led me to become a columnist with, the Bulletin, and since 1990, The Australian. My only regret is that I didn't start earlier. I'm going to do something I've never done before, but I think it's... I'm going to read you a letter. It was only when I was going through preparing the notes that I thought, I've never read this publicly, but I will. This is a letter I received from a gentleman in Queensland, and I'll just read it as it is. Dear Mr. Cohen, my dear wife, blissfully innocent of all things political, recently gave me a copy of your book, Life of the Party, that was my first book, as a Father's Day present. As the wife of an arch conservative, she was somewhat crestfallen when I informed her that the author of the book was a Labour politician. As the book purported to be of a humorous nature, I was able to salve her hurt feelings with the observation that as it was written by a Bolshie, it would have to be a joke. However, you'll no doubt be pleased to learn that the raucous laughter emanating from my study has satisfied her that she made a wise choice in the selection of my present. As a former administrative manager, this is his writing, as a former administrative manager of a light aircraft charter company in Papua New Guinea, I'm particularly aware that flying in such circumstances is 10% boredom and 90% stark terror. Hence, I was able to identify with the obvious discomfort referred to in your chapter, Fear of Flying. The fact that the said discomfort was suffered by socialists added to my enjoyment. Although I cannot, in my wildest nightmares, contemplate ever voting for your thieving socialist party, I assure you that I will not hesitate to purchase a sequel to your book should you care to publish one. In all likelihood, your place in history will be as secured in the company of Henry Lawson and Banjo Paterson as making a valuable contribution to Australian literature rather than for whatever it is you do with yourself in Canberra. I think that's the best letter I've ever had. And I actually, when the new next book came out, this one, I sent him a copy, and you know, he'd said to me, I said, just donate the $20 whatever it was to charity. And I got a letter back saying, stuff the charity, send 10 more copies. I never met the fellow, but I did come across people who knew him. They said he's a scream. He's an accountant from Maroochy, where he was. I don't know whether he's still living. But, some little bit of personal background. I joined the Labour Party in 1963 when all you had to be was a worker. I developed a bit of an inferiority complex because all my colleagues were coming in with BAs and LLBs and PhDs, you name it. I mean, I think we had something like six doctors then. They wouldn't get in now. I had one degree in men's fashion. I owned a menswear shop in the club shop, St. Ives, in St. Ives, which is a great place to open if you're a social democrat or Labour, whatever you want to call yourself, because they weren't exactly, it wasn't a hotbed of socialism in St. Ives. In fact, during the 1975 dismissal, one lady used to stand outside every morning shaking her umbrella at us. My brother Paul was associate professor at Macquarie University. In 1972, when one office, I ran for the ministry and narrowly missed out by 48 votes. I decided to get a university education. This was my great inferiority complex. So I got a mature age matriculation and I went to see the whip. It was Les Johnson, if I think correctly. And I said, I needed time off to go to lectures. And he told me, we'll ask the PM. But unfortunately, you know, fortunately, Gough was a snob on matters academic. If you didn't have a PhD, you didn't get in. Anyhow, he said to me, comrades, this is very good of you, but why are you doing this? I said, well, you're the cause of it. He looked at me. Explain yourself. I said, well, you probably remember that in 1969, when a new breed of Labour politician was emerging, gone were the days of the soup-stained tie and the dirty fingernails and the cloth cap. As I said, all these people with law degrees and PhDs were coming in. And you stood up in front of 2,000 people at the Sydney Town Hall and you said, men and women of Australia, never before in the history of the Labour movement
You mind?
This is what liberals do to you. Where the bloody hell was I? Comrade, he said, this is very good of you, but why are you doing it? I said, well, you know, you're the cause of it. And explain it. Please explain it. So I said, well, you remember you stood up in front of the audience and you said, never before in the history of the labour movement have so many men of academic qualification cast aside their private role to serve the nation. We've got Dr. Bob Wong, IIIC of the Bureau of Agricultural Economics. We've got Major Peter Young, IIIC of the Vietnam Intelligence Unit. We've got Mr. Vince Martin, a senior taxation consultant. We've got Dr. Clugman, a medico. We've got Barry Cohen. From the North Shore. This actually happened. You'd imagine the colour I blushed. Anyhow, I said, and you know, a few weeks after that happened, I was walking out of the airport at Canberra, and he turned to me and he said, I met your brother Paul the other day. I understand he's the cerebral one in the family. But anyhow, it was obvious that I was going to be arts minister. And while never claiming to be the best, second best was the best I could hope for. Gough, of course, was the best. But when I was, long before this, it was clear that I had the makings of an arts minister, because I had this menswear store at St Ives, or Gordon it was, really. And I got an instruction from the designer to go around and buy some bric-a-brac, buy some brass and copper and things from a shop in the main street, Pacific Highway, Gordon. So, and I knew the family well. I mean, I'd been to the... I knew the father, the mother, the sister, the daughter, and the son, who was a five-star nutter. So I thought, oh, well, okay. And I went round and I picked out some nice brass telescope and some, you know, copper and this, that and the other bits and pieces. I got what I wanted. And as I was about to leave, he said to me, why don't you buy some of the son's paintings? I thought, how can he do this to me? I'm a friend of the family. He's going to flog off his nutty son's paintings to me. No way was I going to be caught in this one. I said, no thanks, Mr. Whiteley. Arts Minister, that one. Anyhow, you know, when you're in government, it's in opposition, it's difficult to get to see the leader. When you're in government, it's impossible to talk to the Prime Minister. I mean, they just don't want to know you. They have trouble talking to their ministers. Ask Julia's mob. But one day I'm sitting in the back bench. If I didn't any further back, I'd have been in the toilet. And suddenly the great man loomed up in front of me. Comrade, he said, I need your advice. And I thought, at last I've been called. The great man needs me. What is it he wants to know from him? Areas where I was known nationally and internationally, road safety, sport, tourism, immigration, yeah, these are the issues. I said, yes, Prime Minister. He said, I need some shirts. And I thought, Jesus, this is going to be easy. I thought, but still, we Cohens of this world, it's not to question why. Ours is to, you know, serve the tastes of the rich and famous. So I thought this is going to be easy, because he was 6'5". He had arms like an orangutan. He was the only person I know who could scratch his knees without bending over. And so anyhow, I got Anthony Squires and Coronet shirts to come down. We measured him up, and you know, I don't know whether you know anything about clothing measurements, but in inches, he had, as I said, arms at just. We measured up, and the standard sleeve length in was about 32, 33. Long was 34, extra long was 35. Gough had 38 inch sleeves. And I thought, this is going to be fun.
So anyhow, off they went. I said to me while I was doing, he said, how do you like your sleeve? What length? He said, so I said, single or double cuffs? Comrade, he said, I said, it's a matter of personal taste. He said, well, what do you have? I said, single cuffs. Good, he said, I'll have double. Anyhow, off they went. 3 weeks passed, down came the shirts. I took them out of the Prime Minister's office. Thank you, comrade. And left him there. And about an hour later, I'm having dinner in the parliamentary dining room, and a voice burns. And you see him walking along like this. I should, shit, we're in trouble now. I said, what's wrong? He said, they're too short. I said, they're too short, he said. Leave it to me. I rang up the factory and I went round to see him afterwards. He said, what's wrong? I said, well, they were the measurements they took. He said, well, they're too short. And I said, anyhow, I rang the bloke back and I said, what? He said, well, the factory manager wouldn't believe anyone had arms that long. And I said, well, he'd better bloody believe it because you're going to have to make them all again. So back they went. 3 weeks passed. Back came the shirts. I took them out of the Prime Minister's office. And a voice, and I didn't see him for a while. Thank you, Comrade. Didn't see him for a couple of hours. And I'm in the dining room again. And this, I see him wandering around. He said, can't you Jews get anything right? I said, what's wrong now? He said, they're single cuffs. I said, you're lucky, mate. The factory manager wanted them made an inch narrow around the neck. Gough, he had his likes and dislikes. I'm sorry there's so much Gough, but really, he was a one only. And I wrote a book, Just Life with Gough. He had his likes and dislikes. He didn't like little people. We call it his Gulliver complex. But he also, this one journalist he couldn't stand, well, I don't know, because he seemed to do enough about to me, this fellow called John Monks. But he didn't get along with John. They didn't like each other. He didn't like Monks. Anyhow, one day he was doing an interview with Monks, and he said to him, Monks, are you by any chance related to Lou Monks, who was a well-known author before the war? Yes, said John. As a matter of fact, he was my father. Oh, said Gough. He said, I understand he was, what was the word? I understand he must have influenced you in your choice of career. He said, no. As a matter of fact, he said, no son of mine will ever be a journalist. And Gough said, and he was right. A little rest from God. I was very close friends with Jim McClelland, the late Jim, Diamond Jim. And one of the people he had working for him was a fellow called Howard Nathan. Howard's a brilliant fellow. He was with Jim when we were sacked in the dismissal. And, you know, it was... he went on, you know, obviously didn't stay with Jim any longer. He went on and he became a Supreme Court judge in the Victorian Parliament. So his specialty was, workers' compensation. And he was doing a case for a fellow. He was doing a case for a fellow who had done his back in and believed he would never walk again. And the case was going well at the compensation court when all of a sudden the lawyers for the defence, the insurance company, showed this film or the video of our hero standing on the back of a truck while somebody threw up bags of wheat, and our hero jumped up, caught the bag and stacked it like Kazali. Suddenly there was a hush in the court, and the lawyer for the fellow turned and said, that's you, isn't it? He said, no, it's not. He said, who is this? This is my brother. So he said, just a minute, and he said, look, you've got a call for an adjournment. And he said to this bloke, you will go back and bring in your brother at 2 o'clock, otherwise we don't see each other again. So all right, off he went, 2 hours passed, back he came, with another bloke who looked remarkably like him. So they showed the video again, and it was the brother. Well, the beak went berserk. And he abused the company, and then he awarded them megabucks. What a result. And as they were walking out of the court, Howard said to this bloke, he said, well, that was a good decision, wasn't it? Yeah, he said, it was, Mr. Nathan, but he said, I'm pretty pleased about one thing. He said, what's that? He said, that camera didn't pan back and through it, they're throwing the bags up to it. You'd appreciate that. I wrote a book called What About the Workers? I wanted to show that the trade union leaders or trade union weren't the sour-faced bastards they were always portrayed to the media. I mean, they always came out badly in any depiction of the trade unions. And I knew a lot of very funny people in the trade union. And I asked members, did they know anyone who was a good raconteur? Who could, and Bob Brown, not the Bob Brown we know, but the Bob Brown that was Minister for Transport in the Labor government, took me up to meet a bloke up in Cessnock called, what's his name? Can't remember, it doesn't matter, but he was the funniest man I've ever met in my life. And he told me the story. His best mate in the army during the war was a fellow called Long John Dean. Long John was the tallest man in the army on either side, and he was about 6'10", but he had a terrible stutter. Anyhow, he was a mine. They were not coal miners, and there was a mine disaster, and Long John was sort of dragged out, barely alive, and rushed up to see the mine doctor, Dr. May Harris, and he said. He said, I've crushed me nuts. He said, well, you better drop your trousers down. Let's have a look at this guy. So he did. And he said, oh, geez, we better get you to the doctor quickly. While she did it, she had his pencil out and she put it under his penis, lifted it up and said, oh, geez, this is not good. She said, and he said to her, I bet this old bird's been in a few nests. Yeah, yes, he said, May, as a matter of fact, it has. He said, but it's the first time it's ever sat in the perch. Aren't you lucky that never happened to me? A good-looking woman there is my wife. Maraji Desai, which is was Prime Minister of England in the late 70s, I think it was, for a couple of years. And his great claim to fame was that he was 85 when he got it. And, yeah, that's 10 years older than I am, not 9 now. And we asked when he came out here what was the reason for his longevity. He said he drank a glass of his own urine every morning for breakfast. And Gough was asked to comment on this. And he said, well, I've heard of people getting on the piss early, but this is a big one. My son Adam used to work for me. And he's a very Australian young man. And we used to have offices next door to him, and I heard him say, oh yes mate, no, right mate, okay, he said, just a second, I'll get the old man. He said, it's Gough. I said, you call our great leader, mate? I picked up the phone and said, dear leader, I said, oh, forgive me, I said, I thought I'd bought him up better than that. He said, I don't mind him calling me mate. He said, he doesn't even recognise the voice. John Brown was the Minister for Tourism with me. And Graham Edwards was a minister in a West Australian government, Minister for Sport. But his, not claim to fame, but his what disadvantage was that he had two legs lost in Vietnam. So, but he managed to get around. He was enormously courageous. He's still alive. Enormously courageous fellow. And but he walked. Well, he didn't have any legs. He just got around very quickly without legs. They were at a sports conference in Alice Springs for all the ministers. John was there as a federal minister. Graham was there as a state minister. They decided after the day's proceedings and dinner was over that they'd go down to the casino where they were staying and have a bite to eat. And they went to go in, and the bouncer said, "You can't come in." And he said, "What do you mean I can't come in?" He says, "Not with those shoes on, not with a..." This is to John Brown. He said, "Not with, you know, what do you call it, sand shoes." A very expensive pair of, you know, sand shoes. And anyhow, he said, "You know who I am." He said, "Who are you? You're not getting in with those on." And while this was done, Edwards got fed up and he went straight past, you know, on his wheelchair and into the casino. And John said, "You bastard," he said, "you won't let me in with these shoes on, but you let him in without any shoes at all." Gough rang me one day and he said, "I've just got an invitation to the latest Mundine fight. What do you think that'll do for my image?" I said, not much. Well, he said, "I asked myself, would Roosevelt, de Gaulle or Churchill have gone?" I said, "No, but Caesar would have." With a long pause, he said, "Comrade, I think you've convinced me." When Gough decided to retire, 1978, I ran the first of the farewell to Gough evenings, and at the Central Coast League Club, I represented Robertson, and said, "You know, somebody else made that seat infamous after I left." "Good evening, Belinda. Are you here tonight?" And we put on this, and we within a matter of days, we were sold at 750. And you know, it was fantastic. I had to go on here on Radio 2CR and say, "Look, that's it. There's no more tickets." I was abused by particularly Labor Party people who rang up and said, "How dare you?" But we just didn't fit anymore in. Anyhow, the big night arrived. Dame Margaret arrived and they rushed up the front steps of the league's club and in to have a sherry with the local identities. And Gough came up to her and said, "Comrade, how's it going?" I said, "Wonderful." I said, "You know, it's incredible. When you were Prime Minister, they all hated you." I said, "Then you became Leader of the Opposition for the second time and they still didn't like you. Now you're retiring and they all love you." He said, "They never stopped loving me." He said, "It was you bastards. They hated me." Getting away from Gough again, for giving a bit of... I was Minister for the Arts, but I was also Minister for the Film Industry. And Kim Williams was running the Film Commission. And what I used to do... I wanted to promote Australian films to the politicians and the bureaucrats. So every, you know, twice, three times a year, we'd have a film night and we'd release the latest, we'd show the latest film that was on this particular night, happened to Farlap, which the producer, I used to get the producers and actors there to say a few words to the people who'd come along. We'd get good crowds, get 300. And John Sexton was the producer of Farlap, director, producer, I can't remember which. Anyhow, he told us the story that when he was the night before he had to film 1931, whatever the Melbourne Cup was that Farlap ran, he woke up in the middle of the night and he couldn't sleep because he suddenly remembered the horses had to finish in exactly the same order as they had, you know, 60 years before. So he couldn't sleep, so he got all the jockeys to come to Flemington to talk to them. at 5 o'clock in the morning. So he said, look, Tim, we've got a serious problem. I said, what's that? He said, well, you know, these horses have to finish in exactly the same air that they did in 1931. There was a long silence, and one of the jockeys said, what's the problem? That's why I don't bet. Bob Hawke was a lot of fun. And it's 1975, which the year we ran a big... I talked the Labor Party into having the Federal Conference Labor Party at Terrible. And we had a barbecue up there for the masses. We got 700 turned up at that. And they decided to reenact what they were showing in Old Sydney Town. It was where it was held. And they grabbed Hawke and they threw him in the back of a boat and they rowed out into the middle, and as he stood up, shots rang out, blood spurted out from him, and he fell into the water and it was just chaos. Anyhow, they got him out, rowed him back I forgot to mention they got the cat of nine tails first of all and flogged him with that. Then they shot him and so on. And he said, by God, it's authentic, isn't it? He said, yes, and they said, and so are the fucking wages. One of the pleasures of being a member for Robertson was that one of my constituents was Flo Milligan, Florence, the mother of Spike. And I became very close friends with Spike when he came out here. We had dinner when I went over there in England and so on and so forth. This is why it's not a political story, but it was one of the things that I told him. One of his closest friends and associates was his manager, director, called Jack Hobbs, not the cricketer, but the same name. And Jack had just gone off to Greece for a holiday, and he got a bad attack of diarrhoea. I mean, shit. So he got out of it. He had to get the train to Reading, where he lived. And he was on his way to the station when he had an accident. I don't have to describe what it was. So he went straight to Harrods and bought himself a new pair of trousers and underwear and whole kit and caboodle. And he went to the train, hopped in the toilet, cleaned himself up, grabbed the trousers and underwear and threw them out the window. Put his hand in the bag, pulled out a pink lady's cashmere sweater. It's called the moment of truth, I think. He sat there, not knowing what to do. Finally, he grabbed the pink cashmere sweater, put one foot down one sleeve and the other down another one and pulled it up. The problem would have been solved except that it was a V-neck sweater. He didn't know what to do. There are not a lot of options, I can tell you. But eventually he grabbed his bowler hat, shoved it down the front, did a bit of, you know, careful manipulation, hopped off the train and walked down the station. And Spike said, only in a place like England could you do that, and people would say, even Hobbs. Nothing was out of the ordinary. Those of you who may have read this, I might have read a couple of these stories before, but Jim Cope, who was a member for Sydney and Watson, and then later on Speaker of the House of Reps, he was there when we got sacked by Oscar Whitlam and Clive Cameron. But he was a very funny man, and he was asked by one of his fellow colleagues, members of Parliament, he said to Jim, one of his constituents was nearly blind, almost... little movement in his hands, cardiac disease, almost immobile,
and he couldn't get the invalid pension. What should he do? And Cope said to him, run for the Senate. I won Robertson after the Liberals had held it for 23 years. I held it for another 20, 21 years altogether. And because I'd earned a reputation, I held a Liberal seat for a long time, I was often called in to help struggling candidates. And one day I got a panic-stricken call from Victorian Labor Party, one of the assistant secretaries. He said, I need your help. And I said, what's the problem? He said, well, our candidate is short and ugly, and I want you to come down and polish him up. He fights with everybody. And I said to him, look, keep him out of sight. Let him make the occasional speech. But I said, I can't. He said, he doesn't understand Labor policy. He makes it up as he goes along. I said, for God's sake, go through the policies, explain what he should say, and he said he won't listen. I said, for God's sake, give him the policies, Peter, and tell him to stick to them. There was another pause. I said, what's wrong? He said, you're not going to believe this. I said, what? He said, he can't read. I said, I'll be straight down. Gough was a bloke who visited a lot of electorates. I mean, they all do, but he did a lot. But no Prime Minister had ever been to Coffs Harbour at this stage. So he decided he would make a visit, and he took with him Senator Doug McClellan, who was his Minister for the Media, Kerry Cyber, who was later President of the Senate, and a number of other people. And they arrived at Coffs Harbour on the VIP flight, and there was the usual gaggle of Labor Party supporters there to greet him. And Gough was a lot of laying on of hands and all that usual thing. And the President welcomed him to the thing and said, Mr. President, he said, Mr. Jeff Whitlam, Senator Jim McClellan, and Mr. Terry Sidebra. Gough turned to Doug McClellan and said, comrade, we're amongst savages. After I retired, I spent many years designing and building and creating a wildlife sanctuary in the Central Coast. My son Adam did most of the work, I did most of the worrying. But we used to sell copies of my previous book, and it's a beautiful place. But we had a problem. I'd have stores of these books in there, and the native bushrats got at them. And there's an example of what they did to it. Anyone wants it, it's a little more than the other one. And I rang it off and I said, Leader, I said, you'll be shocked to know that what the bushrats are doing to our book. And he said, and I told him, and he said, well, he said, terrible table manners, but what great literary taste. Lord Curzon, it's not an Australian story, but it's a good one. Lord Curzon was, Governor General of India, and he retired and went into the House of Lords. And his practice was to walk each day from his residence to the House of Lords. And he would stop halfway and have his ablutions at the Athenaeum Club. This went on for some time, and then some of the members of the governing body of the Athenaeum called the secretary manager and said, look, this fellow Curzon, he said, he's not a member of the club. And he said, well,
what should I do? He said, well, tell him he's got to stop coming here. He's not a member. So anyhow, the next day, when he did come in, this secretary managed to bail him up and said, look, he said, I'm awfully sorry, but you'll have to cease coming in here. He said, why? He said, well, you're not a member. Oh, he said, it's a club too, is it? One of my proudest days, I was asked what was the thing that I was proudest of as a Member of Parliament, and it's quickly forgotten, but when I took over as Environment Minister, there was only 14.5% of the Great Barrier Reef region was in the Great Barrier Reef Marine Park. I won't go into all how we did it, but we did. And when I left, it was 85.5%, which is as it is and will remain today. So the fact that I was a chief, that was very proud. But what happened was that when I first became minister, I'd only been there a couple of weeks. And I got a message from the ABC that the crown of thorn starfish were eating their way through the reef. What was I going to do about it? I said, what do you want me to do? Grab my spear gun and go up there and start shooting the bastards? But that didn't go over too well, so I thought, we were having a meeting. We had a ministerial council meeting every twice a year, once in Canberra, once in either Mackay or Mackay or Rockhampton or Townsville or Cairns. I think this was a Townsville we had the half-yearly meeting. And I was asked by Cabinet, we've been asked to do something about it. And they said, well, there hasn't been enough research done on here. We don't know what's causing it. Remarkably little had been done. And but nevertheless, it was suggested that what we need to do is more research. So we had to give, I think we had to give, we gave $2 million and we said Queensland should kick in the same amount. I said, yeah, that's a good idea. Are you going to tell Joe or will I? Anyhow, they said, you can do it. And I said, thanks. So anyhow, we had a meeting and there was a long table from here to there with about 20 people on it. There was Joe and myself and Peter McKechnie and I think it's Barry Jones, the four of us, the Minister of Council. This came up on the agenda, sorry. This came up on the agenda and Joe said, Wally, what's this thing all about, this crown of thorns thing, starfish thing? And he said, I don't know what you're on about. He said, that fellow, what's his name, Professor so-and-so, he took me down there, back 5, 10, 15 years ago, he said, and he showed me the thorn of crowns starfish, and he said there was nothing wrong with it. He said, it was all lovely and gleaming white. There was a deathly silence, and Graham Kelleher, the chairman, stood up and said, Mr. Premier, the reason why it was lovely and gleaming white is that we were dead. I've never seen so many Queensland officials get their heads under the table at the same time.
We may wind up in a minute and take some questions.
No, I'm just about to. I have finished, although I could go on.
Barry,
Richie Gunn. Oh, Richie Gunn. Well, I said that Gough had a problem with short people. Richie was one of a number that was short. There was Al Grasby, John Button, Richie Gunn. But, you know, often the caucus meeting looked like the saddling paddock at Flemington. But anyhow, Gough and Richie didn't get on. They didn't like each other. Gough didn't like Richie. And anyhow, one day, we had the 75 campaign. They were having a meeting, about 300 people there. Gough and Richie were sitting together on the platform. And he's flicking through his pamphlet, Richie's pamphlet. And he said to... he said, Gunn, he said, what's this? And he said, what, Prime Minister? He said, it says here that the Prime Minister offered comment on Gunn's wide general knowledge. Yes, he said, I said no such thing. Yes, you did, Prime Minister. He said, I said no such thing. He said, you did. When? He said, you often call me a fucking little know-all.
Thank you, Barry. We'll have to stay there. Don't... And that's on page 134. That's on page 134. So there we are. So we'll take a few questions and then we'll finish no later than 7 o'clock. Janet Grundy's got some copies of Bringing Down the House. I'm sure Barry would be happy to sign them.
Particularly if it's Bringing the House Down.
Well, we've got another edition as well.
Unfortunately,
we can't offer any rat-chewing, rat-devoured books. But if you come back in a few years, we might be able to work that out. But before I start with questions, just to say once again thanks to Stephen Price and Coors Chambers Westgarth for giving us this great facility at late notice. It's made the whole life a lot easier. I think we'll take Ray's advice. No, just stay there. Don't move. Don't move. Don't move. Ray's in charge. You sit on this table. You sit on that table.
No,
you can sit. No, that's fine. You sit. I think you can do it. Give it a go. Let's see how you go. See how you go. We're right. Don't worry about it. We're fine. We're fine.
Do you remember to sue?
Yeah. Well,
there's just a problem with the microphone. So how
you put him up to this?
No, there's a problem with the television camera. Is the problem?
Ah.
Was Ray's idea? Okay.
Well, I can stand if I can.
Just have a rest for a minute.
Hang on.
The questions are coming thick and fast.
No, the microphones are coming thick and fast. We are beholden here to Austar and Foxtel. We can't do anything without them. So there you go. Now let me know when you're ready with your camera side. Okay. So, we're okay. So, just be fairly brief, because we don't have a lot of time. Tell us a bit about the change in atmosphere. I think the first time I remember meeting you was when I was working for John Howard. You had Paul Eddington from Yes Minister fame down in Canberra. You walked past the opposition leader's office in Old Parliament House, be about 1986. You dropped in, you introduced him to John Howard, you obviously felt comfortable with Howard. So obviously, I can't imagine a Prime Minister now doing that to an opposition leader, whether that Prime Minister was a Coalition Prime Minister or a Labour Prime Minister. Have attitudes changed a bit since your day, or were you just different from all the others?
Oh, absolutely. Better than most. You mentioned Paul Eddington. If I may tell a story about Paul Eddington?
Yep.
Yeah.
Right.
Look, I'd gone through that first period as a minister and gone through exactly the same as Jim Hacker had gone through. You know, introduced to all his departmental heads as the senior secretary, assistant secretary, deputy assistant secretary, and I'd had all that, and it was almost identical to what happened in the Yes Minister. So I.
Go on. It's okay.
So, where was I?
You were Paul Eddington, you've been through the
Anyhow,
whole park.
I was exhausted after my first week, and I went to the airport and threw my bag on the weighbridge and turned to the right, and standing beside me is Paul Eddington, Jim Hack. I couldn't speak, I just grabbed him and hugged him and said, "I'm the new Minister for Home Affairs." Well, we arranged to sit together. We had a wonderful trip. And when we got to Sydney, I said, "What are you doing for the week?" And he said, "Nothing." I said, "Yes, you'd come to our place." And that began a friendship that lasted until he died. He was a lovely human being, Paul. But I must tell you one story. We took Trish, his wife, and Hugo and Geraldine, his girlfriend. We took them on a trip around Australia. We flew to Townsville, got a combi truck, and we drove to Cairns, and we were halfway there and we stopped for a sandwich at Hinchinburn, a cafe there, and we went in, had our meal and went up to pay the bill, and the bloke who owned the place obviously said, "Hey mate," he said, "Palmer's made some bloody good television," and he said, "I'm glad you like it." As a matter of fact, he said, "Do you ever see a show called Yes Minister?" And he said, "As a matter of fact, I do occasionally." "Oh," he said, "I'll tell you what, the bloke in it's your dead set double." And Paul said, "Oh, really?" And walked out. And I said to the bloke, "You know why they look so much alike?" I said, he said, "No." I said, "It was him." Well, I've never seen a bloke go white. But we had some wonderful experiences together. But you asked the question, you know, Paul was, wherever he went,
people wouldn't meet. I mean, Paul's biggest problem he had was that when people thought he was the Prime Minister, he gave it a whole lot. There was 50 countries that was released in different languages. And, you know, wherever he went, they would ask him questions as if he'd just come out of a cabinet meeting. But what was interesting was that, and this is where Paul told me that many of the programs were based on what happened. You know, remember the one where there was the hospital in Britain? That was based on what actually happened. It had been awarded the best hospital, even though it hadn't had a patient. And I don't think anything's changed. I think it's worse now. What?
Lindsay.
You mentioned Bob Brown, and although many of the people you've quoted as being humorists from the left, it seems that the extreme or the semi-extreme left never crack a smile. The Greens never crack a smile. The Liberals crack a smile. Face might fall off. Is that because they all think the world is ending, or is
you make a very good point, and certainly that was my view. I mean, Jim Cairn is the most humorless man I've ever met in my life. I never saw him smile.
Jim Cairn is not in your book, is he? He's not.
Not in this one. No, there's nothing. Well, people said, well, how do you choose him? I said, the only test is it funny. Left, right, centre, doesn't matter. If it's funny, it goes in. If it's not funny, it stays out. But I never heard Jim say anything funny in his life. But there were some very funny. I mean, John Faulkner is one of the funniest people I've ever met. Now, he doesn't necessarily portray this when he's public image on television, but he is hilarious, and some great stories that he's in the book, which you'll buy. But you know, John Wheeldon, well, he went the full circle. He started off as president of the Young Liberals in Western Australia. He joined the Labor Party and became the extreme left. And then over the next sort of 20 years, he circled back and finished where he started. But there are a lot. I think that the left, when they are funny, can be very funny. And Faulkner certainly fits into that category.
Question here, Rob.
Paul Keating called Alexander Down a darling and curly in Parliament. At a later time.
A what?
Darling and curly in Parliament. This is Keating calling Downer, Alexander Downer. Yes. That's the allegation. Go on.
Anyway, but it's
may not be true. It doesn't really matter.
Possibly
a minute.
A later time or a later period to the one that you've been talking about. I'm wondering if there's food for another book of yours on the basis of Paul Keating's humour.
Well, I have used quite a bit of Paul's stuff, not in this book particularly, but Paul could be hilarious. But it was a different sort of humour to say, Fred Daly. Or Jim Killen, or it was just quite unique, Paul. Some of it was cutting and scathing, you know, and some of it could be a bit cruel. I'm sure that'll be a shock to you. Paul and I were elected the same year, 1969. We came in together, and both of us went through another experience. We had viciously fought pre-selection campaigns, and both of us managed to survive. I did mine honestly.
Yes, a question down there. Yep, go on. Yep.
You mentioned that you have been in the seat of Robertson for 21 years.
Just short of 21 years, yes.
Other than you being a funny man, what were the two reasons why people continuously elected you?
The question is, apart from being a funny man, why did they vote you back for 21 years is the question.
Well, I didn't really reveal the humour completely until I was decided to retire, because you have to have a serious po-face for politics. But it's interesting you say that. Why? Because I worked very hard in the electorate. And I say this, there weren't many better people that serviced the electorate than I did. When the money was available, I drove ministers mad till I got the share. When people say, oh, you know, pork-barrel the electorate. Yeah. That's a crime? That's news to me. I thought the job of a Member of Parliament is to get whatever he could for his electorate. Let the ministers and the Prime Minister and the caucus worry if it's too much. Not my job. My job is to get everything I could, or was my job, to get everything I could to the election, and I succeeded. I drove the bastards mad. I used to haunt them around them, and I'd see them hiding from them. They'd see me going, Jesus. And I knew they went into court cabinet meetings, and when money came into me to sue, they said, for God's sake, give Colin what he wants, because he's driving me nuts. I don't make any apologies for that at all.
So we're getting to the end. We have two. There was a question here, and then Wendy. Yeah. So very briefly. Yeah.
Do you think that the coup against Whitlam has had a bad effect
Whitlam?
On Australia? The coup
well,
against
the dismissal of Whitlam dismissal. Has that had a bad effect
has
on?
A bad effect on Australian political life.
Oh well, I think we've got over it. But I mean, I must say that I mean, Gough's been more generous than I have. He's now friends with Malcolm Fraser. How could anyone do that? I've never forgiven the Conservatives for what they did in that particular case. Labor was going to be defeated. There was no question about it because we had not been... Well, we've been a bit unlucky, but we'd also had not been a good government. We'd done great things. Medicare, I think, one of the greatest things that's ever been done in this country by government. And... any doctors here may leave now. Doctor.
Hello.
How's about you?
Thank you.
Oh, he's only here in case your back causes you trouble.
Survivor. He follows me around. Where was I?
The government had its failures, but it was going to lose anyway.
It was going to lose anyhow. And before I am a Labor person, before I'm a Democrat. That's the most important thing to me. And democracy only works, as you'll see if you happen to be studying the Middle East, if the culture is that if you're defeated, you go and you go quietly. And the new Bob got 3 years. We were entitled to 3 years, and they wouldn't give us that. And you know, people say we look like we're in a panic. We were in a panic. We never knew when they were going to block supply next time. And so, you know, I think that it was unforgivable what Fraser did. All he had to do was wait another 15, 16 months, and they'd have been in government. But the tradition of democracy would have been saved. And thank God there hasn't been a lasting impact. It hasn't. But they'd never do it again. And I think they know deep down that they did the wrong thing. It wasn't whether we should or shouldn't be there, but we were elected and we're entitled to serve out our term. And we got both terms cut in half.
Final quick question, Wendy.
What was your last meeting with Gough?
Your last meeting with Gough?
I saw him about 18 months ago. He's not well. Well, he's 96 in a few months' time. Yeah, I saw him, I had lunch with him in Parliament, Old Parliament House.
Okay, well, look, that's been a great fun night. I'll just be very brief in summary. Barry is here with his book, Bringing the House Down, which is another successful publication of Barry Cohen's anecdotes. It was a great fun night, and gives a view of another side of politics. A lot of reporting is very serious, as it has to be, but there is another side of personal involvements of people who can be quite irreverent, and I guess of all the politicians I've met over the years, Barry would be perhaps the most irreverent, and it's great that you can share some of your irreverence here tonight. Another story.
Yeah, well, this was a serious
short.
Where are you going?
What's the bad language?
You said we had till dawn. One of the reasons I joined the Labor Party was because I couldn't stand Jim Killen. I loathed him. I thought he looked like Adolf Hitler, apart from anything else. But I really hated him. In fact, in my maiden speech, committed the unforgivable sin of criticising another member of Parliament. You don't do that in a maiden speech. And I was pulled into order by the Speaker, Sir William Aston. And we used to come, a lot of us stayed at the Currajong Hotel. And you know, after the House had adjourned, there'd be 20, 30 people sitting there drinking coffee and having cheese and biscuits and what have you. And every time I saw Killen, I'd turn the other way or leave the room. One day I thought, I'll stay. Anyhow, I tell you something, it's very hard to hate a bloke that makes you laugh. And he made me laugh like I've never laughed in my life before. And you know, we became the firmest of firm friends. And he came and stayed, his wife came and stayed with us. We went to dinner with him in Brisbane. I was on my way to his funeral when I became ill. And, you know, but it's interesting how that happens, that somebody that you detested for... I got to know that he was not the man he was portrayed, or even he betrayed himself, but he was a lovely human being. And we became, as I said, very close friends.
That's a nice time at which to end. Many thanks, Dan.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.